Welcome to Five Useless Degrees and a Bottle of Scotch. It's your favorite radio show podcast about theater. Do you have any other podcasts or radio shows about theater that you like, Eric?
No.
I'm James Engberg.
And I'm Eric Kilgore. On this week's show, we are going to talk to the co-founder of the August Wilson Red Door Project, Kevin Jones.
And theater around the world, this week in theater history, and other stuff.
Yep.
Welcome to the show. So lately, when I've been telling people about the show,
yeah,
they ask me what scotch has to do with anything.
Right.
We don't really have any scotch around here anymore.
Well, we've changed environments.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually thinking about this just the other day, and I'm bringing scotch in here.
Are you going to?
Yeah.
You don't think you should get that approved first?
No.
Okay.
You just do it, and then you ask for, you know, forgiveness later.
Oh, okay. You just wait till you get slapped on the wrist,
mm-hmm.
and then
yeah.
you ask for forgiveness. Okay.
Right.
I thought you were going to say that maybe we were going to change the title of the show.
Well, we could do that, too.
What would it be called?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, 5 useless degrees and a glass of water.
I don't even have water. What are you talking about?
Well, we need to remedy that as well.
Yeah, we need to have refreshments here.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think somebody should come by with...
with a tray and...
yeah.
Like a selection.
Uh-huh. And cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think so.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to have our interview with Kevin Jones.
Right.
Before we get there.
Yep.
I want to tell everybody what Dennis Sparks has been up to.
Oh, yeah.
And what he's been... what he thinks about these shows.
Okay.
Okay.
Has he seen much in the last week?
Seen 4 things.
Wow. He is a busy, busy person.
Oh, and you'll see, it's not just in one place. He's all over the place.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So the 1940s radio hour at Battleground High School.
Wow.
In Battleground, Washington. There's not enough theater. Listen, there's not enough theater
in the Portland metro area. You've got to go to Battleground.
He has to go to Battleground. There's enough theater for most people, but yeah. not for Dennis Sparks.
And he's going to the high schools, too.
Right. Well, is there a theater company in Battleground?
I don't know.
I don't know either. Anyway, he recommends it. Storefront Theater, Storefront Review, The Babes Are Back.
Ah, yes.
Triangle Productions.
My flask rating of that was kind of low.
Yeah, it was. It was the lowest of the 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he recommends it.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Ramona Quimby at Oregon Children's Theater, the downtown Portland, at a downtown Portland location.
The new mark, yeah.
Yep. He recommends it, but again, you know.
Oh, the parking is an issue.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really, really is.
Maybe he should take public transportation.
Sure, that would remedy that.
Or ride his bicycle.
Or ride a bike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our Country's Good at Bag and Baggage out in Hillsboro. Mm-hmm.
Man, that's a widespread.
I know. Battlegrounds.
Yeah. To Hillsboro, yeah.
He went to Ashland.
Wow.
He recommends this.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and that's what Dennis Sparks is up to.
Okay. Excellent.
All right. Yeah. Okay, it is time for theater history for the week of May 28th through June 3rd. What do you got?
Birthdays this week.
I have a birthday.
Do you?
Oh, not mine.
Oh.
I have one to read, though.
Oh, good.
Okay,
good.
Okay, good.
Yeah. May 29th, 1903, Bob Hope was born.
No way.
As Leslie Town Hope.
Did you know that I won the Bob Hope scholarship in college? I got a Bob Hope scholarship.
What did that consist of?
Some money.
But what did you have to do for it?
I don't know. They told me I got it.
What? You just out of the blue, you got a scholarship?
From Bob Hope. I think I was recommended by one of the instructors or something like that.
Oh. Yes, so Bob Hope was born Leslie Town Hope in Eltham, England.
T-O-W-N?
T-O-W-N-E.
E, town. Yeah, okay,
right.
Okay.
He was born to American parents in England. His father was working as a stonemason at the time in England. They returned to the United States in 1907, and after playing the vaudeville circuit for many years, Hope made his Broadway debut in the 1927 production of Sidewalks of New York.
Nice.
He appeared in a number of productions after that and finally received notice for his portrayal of Huckleberry Haynes in Jerome Kern's 1933 musical, Roberta. From that success, he appeared in several successful Broadway shows, including The Ziegfeld Follies of 1936, mm-hmm. and Red Hot and Blue with Ethel Merman and Jimmy Durante, also in 1936.
Wow.
The following year, in 1937, Hope was given a lucrative radio contract, and he had a weekly show every Tuesday evening. He remained on the radio for nearly 20 years. And in that time, he began appearing in films and on television and made the first road film with Bing Crosby in 1940. During his career, Bob Hope appeared in more than 400 TV programs.
400, not episodes, but 400 programs?
Programs and 75 films.
What?
Hope was also well known for his time spent entertaining soldiers in Europe,
yes,
and the Pacific during World War II, mm-hmm. as well as Korea, Vietnam, and the Gulf War.
Wow. That's a long life.
It is.
A busy one.
Yes. Never having served in the military himself, in 1997, Congress made Hope an honorary veteran of the U.S. military.
In 97?
In 1997.
That's after he gave me money.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, he was still alive. He mm-hmm. he died at the age of 100.
Wow.
In 2003.
Wow, that's an active person right there.
Absolutely.
Okay, actor Joan Copeland was born June 1st, 1922 in New York City. Did you know that Joan Copeland is the younger sister of playwright Arthur Miller?
I did not know that.
Yes, she is. She began her career on the stage during the mid-1940s, appearing in theater in New York City. She is best known for her performances in the 1977 Broadway revival of Pal Joey and her award-winning performance in the 1981 play, The American Clock.
Hmm.
She became one of the very first members ever admitted to the Actors Studio when it opened in New York. She moved into television and film during the 1950s, but maintained an active stage career, and she's still alive.
Josephine Baker was born Frida Josephine McDonald on June 3rd, 1906, mm-hmm. in St. Louis, Missouri. Josephine ran away from home at the age of 13, and she toured the United States with the Jones Family Band and the Dixie Steppers. In 1921, at the age of 15, Josephine married a man named Willie Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And kept his name for the rest of her life, even though she divorced him a couple years later.
Oh, okay. Well, it sounds good, right?
Yeah. Josephine, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Josephine moved to New York in 1923 and then to Paris in 1925 at the age of 19, where she began dancing with several revues, usually wearing nothing more than a feather skirt, or in one memorable show, a skirt made of entirely of bananas.
Very nice. Well, she could have been maybe part of Storefront.
Yeah.
With the costume like that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Sure. In fact, there's video of her some years later in that banana skirt. We will link to that on our website.
How many years later?
Just a couple.
Okay.
All right. Just a few years later.
Okay.
Yeah. And she's wearing a little bit more than just the banana skirt for that video.
Right. So you've watched this video?
I did. Yep.
Once?
One time.
Okay.
Yeah. She became wildly popular in France, and by the end of the decade, she was the highest paid performer in Europe.
No way.
And bought an estate in the south of France.
Really?
In 1936, she returned to the United States, so 11 years later.
Why?
She wanted to come.
She's popular and rich.
Yeah.
And has an estate.
She was convinced to do, actually speaking of Bob Hope's appearance in Ziegfeld Follies of 1936, she appeared in that production.
Okay.
And she received really negative reviews.
Oh, back
from,
to France.
From nearly every outlet. Time magazine published a review in February of 1936 that said, quote, Josephine Baker is a St. Louis washwoman's daughter who stepped out of a Negro burlesque show into a life of adulation and luxury in Paris during the booming 1920s. In sex appeal to jaded Europeans of the jazz-loving type, a Negro wench always has a head start. The particularly tawny tint of tall and stringy Josephine Baker's bare skin stirred French pulses. But to Manhattan theatergoers, last week she was just a slightly buck-toothed young Negro woman whose figure might be matched in any nightclub show, whose dancing and singing could be topped practically anywhere outside of France.
The New York Times.
Unquote.
The New York Times.
That was Time Magazine.
Oh, Time Magazine.
The New York Times was equally unkind,
no.
Although
they did not
go down the racial route. Brooke Atkinson of the New York Times said, quote, "One major disappointment must be bluntly chronicled. After her cyclonic career abroad, Josephine Baker has become a celebrity who offers her presence instead of her talent. Miss Baker has refined her art until there is nothing left of it."
Oh, my
unquote.
Gosh. Oh, my gosh.
So, needless to say, she was not thrilled with that, and she returned to France and married a Frenchman and changed her citizenship.
Well, as she should.
And she finally returned to New York in 1973 to perform at Carnegie Hall and received standing ovations.
Oh, very nice.
In 1975, she had, just weeks before she died, she had a 50th anniversary of her Paris debut, and that was the last thing she performed.
Oh, well, so she passed away in France?
Yes, in
okay.
Paris, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Wow. Three amazing lives, all from the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that it for birthdays?
That's it for birthdays.
What else?
Shows that opened this week in history. Eric Bogosian's Talk Radio. You remember that show?
Yeah, I've done monologues from that show.
Debuted.
I'll do one right now.
No. Please don't.
Okay.
It debuted at the Public Theater May 28th, 1987. The production was directed by Frederick Zollo and produced by Joseph Papp. It ran for 210 performances. Bogosian starred in the film adaptation, which I think most people know, directed by Oliver Stone the following year.
Yeah. Oh, so this didn't open, but it was playing during this week in 1904.
Oh, okay. Just it.
It was running. It was running, right.
Okay.
The Southerner was playing at the New York Theater this week in 1904. It contained a score by black composer Will Marion Cook, and it was the first time an entire black chorus was used in a show with a white cast. Lead Eddie Leonard appeared in blackface in this musical about the antebellum South. More than the production itself, the New York Times dwelled, New York Times again, New York Times dwelled on the fact that white members of the cast, quote, mingled with the black performers, and that only some of the audience members trembled in their seats during the curtain call. It played for only 36 performances. But Will Marion Cook, who composed the score, was born Will Mercer Cook. He wrote several Broadway musicals. He was also a skilled violinist who, with financial help from his community, at the age of 15 was sent to Oberlin Conservatory to study violin. During 1894 and 1895, Cook studied with Czech composer Antonín Dvořák at the National Conservatory of Music. He performed professionally as a student and made his debut as a violinist in 1889 in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So quite a life as part of that production that was running.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy
a
cow.
Life probably bigger than the show, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. June 3rd in 1975, the musical Chicago opened.
Oh, yay!
At the 46th Street Theater.
Mm-hmm.
The production was directed and choreographed by Bob Fosse and starred Jerry Orbach as Billy Flynn and Cheetah Rivera as Velma Kelly.
Incredible.
It was nominated for 11 Tony Awards in 1976, but did not win a single award.
I didn't know that.
Do you know what happened to win 11 Tony Awards that year?
Oh, no.
Something that opened a few months later?
Oh, no, no. What?
A Chorus Line.
Oh. Over Chicago?
Over Chicago. Chicago ran for 936 performances.
Wow. Well, okay, but those two shows opening proximity, that's pretty incredible.
A couple months apart, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. All right.
All right, that is This Week in Theater History for the week of May 28th.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Five Useless Degrees and a Bottle of Scotch with James Engberg and Eric Kilgore on X-Ray FM.
So we were able to sit down with Kevin Jones at Artist Rep a few weeks ago and had a fascinating conversation.
It was a great conversation.
Yeah.
I really loved talking. I had never met him before.
Right.
And to get to speak with him and learn about the work he's doing, totally fascinating.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. All right. Well, here is that interview.
Our guest this week is the co-founder of the August Wilson Red Door Project. He is a professional actor and director who has worked with numerous companies across the country for more than 30 years, including the Actors Conservatory Theater, San Jose Repertory Theater, Repertory Theater of St. Louis, and the Stanford Actors Project. Locally, he has worked with Portland Center Stage, Third Rail Repertory Theater, Portland Playhouse, and Artist Rep, where he is a resident artist. In 2010, he received a Drammy Award for Best Actor in a Supporting Role for his portrayal of Old Joe in Radio Golf. His directing credits include Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, The Piano Lesson, Seven Guitars, The Motherfucker with a Hat, and Blood Knot. Kevin Jones, welcome to Five Useless Degrees and a Bottle of Scotch.
What a great title. What a great name. Five Useless Degrees.
Well, we don't utilize our degrees at all. So
I like it. But it's important to have them, those 5 degrees.
We're less convinced of that. We're not so convinced.
It lets us talk.
For no other reason, you got a great title for a show. I mean, you know.
Okay.
And it lets us talk to people like you. So.
Okay. There you go.
First thing I want to ask you about is the Red Door Project itself. The Red Door Project takes its name from the front door of one of August Wilson's characters,
right?
Aunt Esther.
Aunt Esther.
She's referenced in 5 of Wilson's plays, I believe, but she only appears in one,
right?
Gem of the Ocean,
right?
And in King Hedley II, she is reported to have died at the age of 366,
right?
Which would mean that she was born in the year 1619,
good,
which is the year that the first slaves were brought to the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
Given all that, what does Aunt Esther's Red Door represent? And what does that mean to the Red Door Project?
Okay. So the actual name of the organization is the August Wilson Red Door Project. And we've shortened it because just, I think, through convenience and just what's popular, people have just sort of distilled the name down to the Red Door Project.
Right.
When we decided to create the organization and use August Wilson's name, I felt like it was important to get the permission of the widow, Costanza Romero, to use the name. So we arranged to have a breakfast with her up in Seattle. So me and my wife, Leslie, we drove up to Seattle, and we had a great breakfast. We asked her, you know, if we could use his name. We told her what we were about. She said she was really excited and really honored. And she said, I want to take you for a walk. And so she took us to a park in Seattle. And there, as we approached sort of an entrance into the park, a walkway, was this big red door and had a large picture of August Wilson right in the glass and had a list of all of his plays. And the door was about 12 feet high and about 4 or 5 feet wide. It was a beautiful door. And she said that she had that door built in honor of August Wilson. And we looked at it and we took pictures, and it was an amazing door. And the road that the door opened out into was called August Wilson Way. So we said, okay, we've got to call this the Red Door Project. So yeah, Aunt Esther, as the story goes, as is told in Gem of the Ocean, whenever a slave, an ex-slave, migrated from the South to Pittsburgh, he was told, or she was told, before they could go anywhere, before they could get a job or do anything, they had to go see Aunt Esther. Where's Aunt Esther? Well, she's at 1839 Wiley, and you can't miss her. You can't miss the house. It's a big red door in front of it. And what Aunt Esther would do is she would take you on a journey. They called it the City of Bones. And that City of Bones lived under the sea. And there lived or existed the bones of all of the slaves that didn't quite make it through the Middle Passage. And the purpose in visiting that City of Bones was for the individual, for that ex-slave, to be reminded of the shoulders upon which they stood, that these people died for you to be free. And even though you may have had to live a life as a slave, you're no longer a slave. And it's important now for you to let those, untie yourself of those shackles and go forth and live your life and be free. But before you do that, you have to free yourself of your own internalized oppression, your own self-hatred, your own doubts, the questions you have in yourself, how you've internalized the beliefs of the white culture. And as a way to survive, you had to internalize those beliefs. But now, if you're going to be free, as Citizen Barlow did in Gem of the Ocean, he had to let go of that guilt and that self-hatred so he can go off and live his life. And that's why we call it the Red Door Project, because what we were shooting for was not just freeing African Americans, but everyone in Portland. Our own, we all have so much internalized oppression, we all have so much fear, so much doubt about connecting and mixing it up with people that are different from us. And that comes from our own internal fear, because it's certainly not anything that's going on outside of you. So the theme represents itself for all of Portland, not just people of color.
If you are just tuning in, you are listening to 5 Useless Degrees and a Bottle of Scotch with James Engberg and Eric Kilgore on X-Ray FM. This week, we are talking to the co-founder of the August Wilson Red Door Project, Kevin Jones. So the mission of the August Wilson Red Door Project is to change the racial ecology of Portland through the arts.
Right.
Can you explain what that means in specific terms?
Sure. To change the racial ecology of Portland. So what do I mean by ecology? So if you think about a garden, ecology is a biological term. If you're thinking about a garden, you know, you've got plants and you've got grass and dirt and soil and butterflies and water and sunlight and bees and other stuff. And you take any of that out, all of those things make up the garden, right? They make the garden exist as it exists. All things flourish when it's balanced. You take any of that out, you take out the sunlight, you take out the water, you take out the bees, then things get marginalized, things die, things don't thrive. So racial ecology is based on the idea and the notion that we as a people, even though we may be different racially or ethnically or class, education-wise, or whatever, that we all have something to contribute. We all have something to bring to the culture, to the community. And by marginalizing any one group, the main culture suffers. So that's the ecology part. So changing the racial ecology through the art. You know, art was at one point in time, I think, you know, it was designed as a way, it emerged, I believe, as a way for human beings, culture, to be self-reflective, to see themselves. And then the artist's job was to interpret the culture through the art. They do that through theater, paintings, photographs, dance. But it's where we come to sit down and observe our culture and how it manifests itself. And sometimes it's really the only way to do that because, you know, you can't see yourself from inside yourself. And it's a way of being affirmed. When we get to show up at a theater and we see a story that reflects who we are, it affirms who we are. So when we can encourage theaters or the art or community to become more diverse in their thinking, mm-hmm. and to be more inclusive with the kinds of aesthetic and the kinds of artistic interpretations that they allow to be presented on their stages or in their houses, then we will, one, we will attract a broader base of people. We'll have more diverse people that will show up. And hopefully in doing that, we will bring more people out of the margins into the mainstream.
So you've talked a bit now about how art is enables reflection of our identities towards rebalancing that cultural ecology and the city's cultural ecology. Is theater particularly well suited to that goal? And does the Red Door Project privilege that art form?
So here's the thing. I think if I understand your question, the first part of it anyway, is I do think that theater does serve the culture better than other art forms, because we get to see people on stage working out relationships, right? And if it's done well and written well, then we learn from that. I mean, when the first time I saw August Wilson, as an example, I can speak from my own experience, was Fences with James Earl Jones and Mary Alice on Broadway. And I'll tell you, I'd never heard anyone talk, those people in August Wilson's plays, they sound like my mother, my father, my uncles, my grandfather, you know, the people I grew up with, the people on the street corner, the winos, the guys in the barbershop. And, you know, when I would walk down the street and I'd hear winos talking like that, my mother would say to me, "Don't you talk like that. Don't you ever let me hear you talking like that." Or I'd go in the barbershop and hear them talking. "Yeah, man, let me tell you. Pass me that, man. Give me a cup of coffee. Oh, man, don't. It's whatever." I heard, you know, because I grew up in New York, I heard, "Don't talk like that. That's bad talk. That's bad English. That's ignorant." So I go see Fences, and I hear James Earl Jones talking like that for 3 hours, and everybody else on stage talking like that. And not only was he talking like that, but it was beautiful. It was poetic. It was musical. I cried. I cried before there was anything to cry about. I was so deeply moved. And every time I see an August Wilson play, that's what happens for me. So I think, for me personally, seeing those kinds of stories reflected does affect me on a cultural level. I learn from that. It's very meaningful for me to sit next to somebody that's different from me to watch that kind of story, because there's something about coming out. It's like, yeah, that's my story, you know? And I feel like I'm sharing it, even though I had nothing to do with it. I feel like it's now a part of a bigger, you know, a bigger picture. I'm sharing it with the people in the house, you know? And talkbacks are great when you can do that. You can share about that.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will have more of our interview with co-founder of the Red Door Project, Kevin Jones.